We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
Good morning, and thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I highly appreciate you being here once again this week. I didn't purposely do two cultural or culture-based interviews in a row, although we do delve into some entrepreneurship in this one, but it just kind of happened that way with Dr. Kuroda last week, and then, of course, Jason this week. And you know what I love? I love that it's called the Pauly Guglielmo Show, and I can do that. I think the person who said it first, when he used the word ostensibly, was Rotary past president Jeff Halleck, when he was on the podcast and said the podcast was ostensibly about entrepreneurship. Secretly, I Googled the word ostensibly for a definition and found that it means that it's supposedly or, you know, kind of supposed to be that, but not always is. And that's exactly how I would describe this, and I would have it no other way. In fact, I'd like to tell you something that I was potentially not planning on telling you, because I'm worried it's going to sound like a humble brag, but I don't want it to be a humble brag. I just want to explain what it is that I'm doing here with this podcast. And I was extremely honored recently to be approached in Rochester by a major media conglomerate, a traditional media outlet, who came to me and said, "Hey, what do you think about making your podcast exclusive to our brand?" So again, I don't necessarily want to say exactly who I was talking to, but one of the traditional media outlets came and said, "We'd like to make your podcast exclusive to us. We'll sell advertising on it. You'll get this traditional, sort of airtime." What a deal. What a deal we can make. And the pay, they were going to pay me through potentially trade advertising. And there was something about that that was attractive. You know, first of all, let's admit it. There's something about the ego hit that comes from being approached and somebody saying, "We'd like your podcast to be on our network," right? There's something about that. Beyond that, you know, there's some true value in trade advertising, especially on a media outlet like that. There's value there. But entering into a deal like that, to me, would make me beholden to them. It would turn me into, whether they would describe it this way or not, they probably wouldn't agree with me saying this, but it would turn me into an employee, in my opinion. It would make me feel as though I owed them something. Because now I'm worried, is the podcast good enough? Can they sell advertising on it? Are people going to complain? Are they getting their money's worth? I mean, when you hire me, you hire somebody who is going to be just exhaustingly focused on making sure that I am providing value. And so if I commit to you, that's what you're going to get from me. And I just don't have the capacity for it for this podcast. Do you know what I mean? It was like, I have a business that is growing, that has my heart, that is where my professional focus needs to be. Never mind a young family, which is where my personal focus is, that takes up a lot of time. But any professional time there is needs to be spent cultivating and growing Craft Cannery. So I turned it down. I said no. And you might be saying, "Well, Pauly, wait a second. Aren't you on this Lunchador podcast network?" Yes, I am. But let me explain how that's quite different. The Lunchador podcast network is not not a traditional media outlet. There's not a lot of obligation on my part to be a part of this network. And by the way, if the
the guys who run the network are listening to this, don't let this like freak you out and think like, geez, if we ever ask Polly to do something, he's going to feel obligated. No. This was a whole different level. This was like, I was going to have to go to their studio to record. Again, they were going to sell advertising. It was like a whole different level. So it's nothing. Lunchador is just a wonderful, beautiful collective group of local artists and champions for this community who are not asking too much of each other and are just focused on putting out content every week. And I love the Lunchador Podcast Network for that. I love that it's not a corporation, frankly, I guess is where I'm going with this. And of course, this traditional media outlet was, and that is nothing against them or anyone that works there. It's just not something I was willing to sign up to be a part of. Again, remember, I already did that. So anyway, that's all. I just wanted to explain. This podcast is really, at its core, my hobby. This is my one hobby. That is all this is. This is just the one hobby I have. I have said it before. I will say it again. I absolutely fell in love with and will always be in love with radio. But it wasn't in the cards for me to stay in radio for my whole life. And this is my way of just scratching that itch once a week. So I appreciate you hearing me out. I don't know if it was a good idea or not to even mention that deal was potentially a part of the was even possible. Actually, the reason it is even coming up is because this was supposed to be the last podcast on Lunchador. Then I was going to switch to this other network. But again, I said no, and I just am as happy as could possibly be doing this podcast exactly the way I'm doing it right now, and nothing should change. So there we go. That's that. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please enjoy From a Bureau, Jason Barber. Buddy.
Hi.
I'm honored that you're here.
To be invited.
Dude, I mean, we came all the way to Bergen for this.
That's not far from me. I grew up in Chi-Lai.
Oh, fantastic.
In Churchville, so.
I'm glad to hear you say it's not far. I mean, I know for you, you grew up over here, but a lot of people in Rochester, when I say we're in Bergen, they think we're an hour away. You know, like, it's right down the road, dude. It's not bad. And it's technically Genesee County, but, like, you probably saw the sign right out front. Like, it's just Genesee mm-hmm. County, mm-hmm. which is good for tax reasons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Genesee County, man. It's a little cheaper.
We also got Ralph and Rosie's out here.
Oh, you know Ralph and Rosie's?
Yeah, man.
Dude, that is some local shit.
Yeah. I mean, we got pizza at Ralph and Rosie's. I mean, I went to Churchill Chi-Lai, so.
Yes. Yes. You know what's funny? Just a few weeks ago, I was interviewing somebody, the George from Rock Barbecue Supply, and we talked about Ralph and Rosie's. And I've had so many people come up to me and be like, tell me about this Rosie Ralph place. And I'm like, dude, Ralph and Rosie's, like, if you know, you know.
You know.
It's Bergen. It's the Bergen pizza.
It's not the Bergen pizza. It's like the best Western New York pizza, yes. I think, period. I think, like, when everyone talks about, I like the Detroit-style pizza. I like this. Detroit-style pizza is just a glamorized Pizza Hut pizza. This is what Western New York is good. It's dough. Thin layer of sauce.
Like the personal pan pizza from Pizza Hut?
Yeah, because that's everything it is. Like, oh, I would Detroit style. It's a pan pizza from Pizza Hut.
Yeah. Are you old enough to remember the Book It program?
Yes.
You get your own pan pizza.
Oh, yeah. You get a book in that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Oh, dude.
I remember when the Ninja Turtles advertised it, and you saw, like, the Ninja Turtles ads.
Yes.
And you get the Ninja Turtles rock video with Pizza Hut.
Yeah, I brought my child to see Ninja Turtles at the movie theater.
It
was like the 35th anniversary. No, it was in the regular. This was actually in Webster. They did a showing, and you know, he's six. That's maybe just a touch early.
It's a pretty dark movie. The
first one is dark. That's where I was going with this. It's darker than I remember. Because two, The Secret of the Ooze, is like way more geared towards kids.
Oh, yeah.
One is kind of like, you know, there's some murder in there.
Mm-hmm.
There is at one point, maybe one of the funniest scenes of cinema of all time is a rat in a cage doing karate.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But it is a little dark.
I mean, Raphael almost dies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, well, I'm so glad. Oh, my God. I'm so glad you're here. We're going to talk a little bit of food, too,
yes.
and culture. And it's funny, too, because, you'll be the second kind of, this is mostly an interview, a podcast about entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
But like, whatever, I can change it if I want. And last week was also culture. In real time, it doesn't air till this Sunday, but it's Joel Carota from the Casa Italiana at Nazareth.
Nice.
And so also Culture Talk this week. I like it. But where I want to start is I was looking you up. I just want to know more about you because I don't really know you. And one of your lines in your LinkedIn says that you're a community engagement expert.
Yeah, it's BS, but it's good. But it's true.
That is what a...
I have a good way of... I grew up with like my abuelo and my mother are very good at connecting people, and I think I've inherited that trait. It's one of my strong traits, and I understand the community. I understand how everything's interconnected.
Yeah.
And I understand how stuff, you know, everyone needs to be working together to build something stronger now. It's not this, I think our generation is a very unique generation because we're the ones who watch the baby boomers eat each other alive. Like every way, from nonprofits to business.
Uh-huh.
And I think collectively, that's the only way we're going to survive the, you know, like difficult times, you know, recession and everything. Our generation experienced so many recessions. We're like, nah, I got to partner with that person.
Dude, we're like unfazable, honestly. Yeah. You're right about that. We've seen a lot.
And I think that helps us with understanding. We're better understanding the reality and the necessity of real community in any form, from businesses to culture to, and I think that's what's really unique. So yeah, that's what my LinkedIn says, you know, and I think I agree with it. I am a community engagement expert.
Are you a millennial or a Gen Z? You with me with the millennial?
I am an Xennial.
Xennial, okay.
So 1982. So I am the in between, they call it the Xennial, 80 to 84.
Okay, then I'm with you. I'm Xennial as well. Yeah. Exactly. I'm 83. So we're in the same boat. So I love it.
We're the middle children.
Because we understand the community coming together. How did Eliza say, we're the elder millennials?
Yeah, we're the elderly millennials. I like to say we are the baby siblings of the Gen Xers and the older siblings of the millennials.
Yes.
Like, we're always that middle child that kind of goes like, we understand everything, but we're the ones who also have to like see how everything's connected. Because like the Gen Xers don't really want to work. They have their own thing. They're very individualistic. Uh-huh. They have to make everything on their own from the ground. They do have their own communities, but it's, you know, and then the millennials are very.
You said we understand how important community is, but isn't it funny because the boomers or even the generation above them looked at us as anti-community because we were internet people.
Yeah.
We were like the first people that were like, you can text instead of call. And to them, that was insane. Mm-hmm. Why would you text them when you can call them? But look, obviously, look where the world has gone. But so as a community engagement expert, what I love about that the most is because I am a part of so many different groups that are trying to hold events and make the community be interested in coming to the event. What have you found is important, is vital? I mean, the International Plaza, like, you've done this.
Yeah, we had 3,000 people just for one event recently.
How do you get the community to, A, even hear about it, and then, B, say, I want to go to it?
Ah, that's a great question.
It's loaded, I know.
It's a very loaded question, but I think...
Get right up.
Oh, yeah, sorry. But, you know, I think one of the core aspects for me is when I look at where the International Plaza is, which is over in North Clinton, it's in a predominantly historically Latin neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It's where my family and my Cuban side arrived in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. And I think that aspect of everybody has to do it and everybody doesn't speak up about it. And we have to figure out ourselves. And I think a lot of it, when I look at Ibero, the nonprofit that I'm part of, and IADC, everybody does 20 different jobs. We like to joke that at Ibero, we do more than most nonprofits do in a day. We all do. It's just one individual, each of our jobs. And we get paid about 10 times less. And it's true. We do all the outreach. We do the community stuff. We develop the structures and analysis. And we are working to help our community grow and strengthen our community and our entrepreneurs and our businesses. And I think when it comes to like outreach, that can be difficult. You know, when we talk about where the plaza is, it's in North Clinton. You know, it's a neighbor that hasn't. The news is not very friendly.
Sure.
To that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I think that's something I always try to be like aware of. Hey, yes, this is not a very, you know, it has its issues with drugs and homelessness, but it also has a beautiful community that really strives to better themselves and to better their community. And what I love about being part of Abero and IADC is that that's everybody's purpose.
Yeah.
Everybody who wants to do that has that. And I think that's been a unique way of reaching out and creating community, has been having a strong community behind you. Mm-hmm. The idea that our president, Angie, is amazing, and she understands that, you know, and Miguel Menendez, who's the president of city council, but is also the head of community engagement for IADC. He's understood that, like, the plaza was a way to redevelop the neighborhood in a way that's healthy and organic, you know, and we didn't just do the plaza and say, hey, we're going to have a bunch of shipping containers, start your own business. Like, no, they built new roads on the side streets. They took what the vacant lots in and put rent to own homes in it. They moved, they helped move a barrow that used to have its headquarters downtown, and they moved it right behind St. Michael's. They built a community resource center that's not even two blocks away, you know? And so we have 225 buildings that are surrounding the plaza that are all low-income apartments.
Have you been around since the inception of just the idea of the International Plaza?
No.
Do you know the history if we go into
that?
Yeah,
I mean, the history goes back before I was born.
Well, I was going to say, can we go back? I was going to say, can we go back to where you were born? But you're from Chilai?
Well, actually, I was born in the city. Okay. I was born in the Maplewood neighborhood, Kodak Park. Proud of it, you know.
Yeah.
In the blood on my dad's side. My dad's Italian American.
Was your Italian and Cuban?
Yeah, I'm Italian and
Damn,
Cuban.
Buddy. Yeah. All right.
Or that's like cool to say, combo. Like I like to say, I'm Cuban and Rochesterian, because the Italian side has been here for like 100 years.
Yeah. Okay.
You know. So like, and also my great grandmother on my Italian side, down to my dad, all worked at Kodak.
Okay. Got it.
So there's three generations that are literally worked, lived, and are buried behind Kodak at Holy Sepulchre.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So what brought the barbers to Chilai?
The barbers moved to Chilai because of me. You know, like my mom wanted a better school. We were out in Gates at the time, and you know, there was a better art program. There's better programs. One of my middle brothers struggles with a lot of learning disabilities. They had a better program and special ed programs. And we were already living in Gates at the time, so we just crossed over the line and moved over to Churchville. And it was a great experience. Churchville Chilai, a saint through and through, and it was a great school, great art classes and programming. So I got to really develop my artistic talent, and I got to already there. And in many ways, there was already a community structure. Our teachers would kind of keep us in the same cohort. So years later, when I got out of college, I got involved with the yards and the art and the wall wall therapy, which really had three or four Churchville grads. My friend Marissa Kroll, my friend Lisa Barker, they both were part of the yards and wall therapy early on, and they just dragged me into it. And it was just like a little cohort of Churchville kids that were part of it.
So how old are you at that time? I mean, you're just still a teenager?
I'm 20s by the time wall therapy started. Okay. I'm in my late 20s with wall therapy.
What did you want to be when you grew up? Like, is this something you was your eye always here, or were you going to go be
I wanted to be Bob Iger, the head of Walt Disney Corporation, or Michael Eisner, you know, like that was my real dream. I actually was either that or a movie director or an artist. Like, those were kind of the avenues I portrayed. I went to college, just went to SUNY Purchase for art and art history. Then I went over to Roberts over here for my master's in ed. So I became a teacher for about 10 years in the city school district. But even when I was teaching in the city school district, I really was involved in the arts. I was involved with the yards and then wall therapy and 1975 Art Gallery. And I got to really work with a lot of the murals that you see around Rochester, the 225 different murals that we have in our city.
225 different stories, but can you give me one mural story that just stands out, that's just like,
oh my gosh,
here's how this got there and here's the beautiful story behind it?
I'm trying to think of one.
I'm trying to put you on the spot.
I think one of them is, and I kind of go back to Churchville, is one of my friend, Brittany Williams. We did a mural in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood about the women of Gies Bend in Mississippi, this predominantly black community that has stayed really untouched since the time of slavery. And we did this mural, and it was just really unique to see so unique to see in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood, which is a predominantly African-American neighborhood, that they got to see a face that, you know, like, and it wasn't Susan or Frederick. Mm-hmm. It was this African-American, beautiful African-American woman. And we had so many people come up to us. And, you know, for Brittany, who and I, you know, who I've known since she went to high school with my little brother, you know, it was just a unique experience. And it strengthened our friendship as well, just to be with somebody who I trusted and who, she, you know, she trusted me, just to work on a painting together and see her shine was like the best experience to
it's
see.
It's still there?
I think there was some damage. They may actually have taken it down recently. Okay. It's actually owned by, I think it's gonna be, what are they? Oh, it's the new Visual Studies Workshop.
Okay, got
yeah,
it.
That's right. The building.
Okay, well, that's great. So you got into, everything you were talking about, it was in your 20s, right? So you start to get into...
And in my 30s, like early 30s, yeah.
This is where this idea back of being like the community engagement expert, this is where this really starts to fester, it sounds like, right?
Yeah.
And become a thing. And so you fall in love with it. And what do you pursue after you're a teacher? You do that for 10 years. That's your living. Is it Barrow right after that? Or?
No, actually, okay. I was teaching and then I started working. I was on and off working within the nonprofit world. Again, kind of learning development, and which is, again, community engagement. You're already building these connections with the community and using some of those connections that I learned at Well Therapy. Because for me, Well Therapy is this community. It's a family of people that we it's all volunteers. Everybody, you know, we do all these murals. We raise up to sometimes up to $50,000 for a season of murals.
Cool.
You know, but most of the seasons are around $20,000. But we all raise them. We do the fundraisers. And then we all organize it. We're the ones helping the artists get the walls prepped. We're grocery shopping. We're driving them. We're also spending time with them. I got to go to Berlin to meet some of these artists, wow, you know, and spend time with them. And I've developed friendships with artists from all over the world that I never would have had. So a lot of that was this unique experience of having that community development experience and then moving it into the nonprofit world. I worked at Catholic Family Center until the pandemic, and then the pandemic happened, and I was back to teaching when I got out of the pandemic for 2 years. Yeah,
oh, wow.
I did back to teaching art at 2 charter schools, and then I worked at Center for Disability Rights doing development again. And then one of the unique parts was during that period of the pandemic, I got asked to sit on the Latin Roundtable Board, which is the Latino leadership. So Miguel, Angie, many of the Latino leadership, I was asked to sit on, and I developed all these amazing relationships because it was like sitting on a board full of my Latin cousins.
These are my people.
Yeah, yeah. So it was almost natural to talk about it. And, you know, Miguel was like, hey, I have this position open. I want to poach you. And you're the only person I'm thinking about. And he was surprised that I said yes, because I was making more at my previous job. And he's like, but I think you would like this more.
Sure. And isn't there something about, like we just said, when you find your people, isn't there something about when you finally get to look around and go, oh, these are my fellow nerds of whatever you're.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The people that you saw me walking out when you got here, those were the process authorities, which doesn't mean anything, but to me, like, those are my people. Like, we were sitting here talking about food safety parameters and like a software program to like measure. You know what I mean? But like when you're with your people, you're just. You remember being in high school and staying up all night playing video games? Like I was with the order pizza case of Mountain Dew or Jolt, and play video games all night, and like those were my people.
Yeah.
I was not go out and find alcohol guy. I was never go out and find girls guy. I wanted to be, but I couldn't be, you know. But like you're with your people. But so did you feel that in you're like, these are my
well,
people.
Yeah, I think I felt like, you know, one of my the head of IADC, Iberian American Development Corporation, Eugenio Marin, is this older Dominican gentleman, amazing role model, amazing like just an elder that you can listen to. I'm sitting there last year when I was running one of the events, I believe it was like International Day of Salsa, and he just leans over and he says, welcome home.
Oh,
you know, like this beautiful. And it was just like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
This is where I needed to be. And it's been a blessing, you know, like my bosses are all amazing people, and it really is like a joy. And I remind them that to annoy and fault.
Yeah.
That I'm like, I love what I'm doing here.
Okay. Well, yeah. That's going to stop them from giving you a raise. Because they'll be like, well, he's too happy to leave. So, you know, you still got to ask for the
that's
raise.
That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I do remind them. I'm like, I'm not making enough.
Yeah, yeah, that right. Like, yeah, yeah. I love it, but I got to, okay.
But it's like, yeah, and that's been one of the big joys. And that's why I started my film series now with the George Eastman Museum. I was just like, I wanted to do a Latin film series. I got the right people involved. And then as soon as I met Jared, who's the director of curation there, he was like,
yeah,
he was like, it was like geeks.
Yeah.
Two geeks.
Can we talk about the International Plaza?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to actually go back to the beginning. Like you weren't there from the beginning, but you know the history.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the light bulb moment for the International Plaza? Who first said, you know what we should do?
There's many people. I'm still learning where it comes, but I believe Albert Burgos a long time ago in the 70s when, you know, North Clinton was and into the 80s, they had talked about, Ibarra had talked about creating a place like the Plaza. But I think the fruition of it came with Eugenio Marin, Miguel Menendez, Jim Carr, and actually Lovely Warren, you know, who all really got behind it and said, we want to do something in this neighborhood. We want to take shipping containers and we want to turn this into a park. And Malik has been 100% on board with everything. So is Adam Bello. So it's been really unique to kind of see the community, the county, and a lot of people working hand in hand at this place. And also Jim Farr, who is the, you know, he's in charge of the public market and he's been kind of the go-to, and he's the one who redeveloped and reshaped the public market the way we know it is as it is today. And I think he loves that place. He spends Sundays at the Plaza. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, Jim, aren't you supposed to be over at the market? Like, they're doing an event. It's like, I don't care. He has his lawn chair out and he's sitting eating an empanada and he's just like, eating some ice cream and walking around going, like, Jason, what were you doing here? What's this? You know, like, what do you think? How many people are going to come? And I'm like, yeah. Like, so it's, I've been blessed to have like really great leadership who, kind of, you know, who really kind of guides us. And then also having a Barrow be behind it, Augustine Rodriguez, you've probably met, he's in charge of the International Business, a Barrow Business Center, which is, it's not just one, we have Geneva branch, we work with branches in Niagara Falls and in Amsterdam, New York. So it spreads off, like helping to flourish and strengthen a Latin-owned businesses or really just any minority-owned businesses and small businesses. So he's been kind of spearheading that, but he has been such a great person because he loves working with our vendors. Mm-hmm. And he really is the one kind of saying, hey, there's this person who went through our class in Geneva. Oh yeah, there's this person who went to our class down in, like down at the, you know, over in Clifford. I think they would be great for the Plaza. And he's been, you know, he'll check in on them. He does his corporate meetings at the Plaza with, you know, like last week he was sitting there and he was helping with the taxes with one of our vendors. You know, so
what a cool resource.
Yeah,
what a
and great it's resource. I think everybody is like that. Like Miguel, you know, doesn't have to take his meetings at the Plaza, but he'll take his meetings at the Plaza, have his empanada, his arepa, you know, or have some Mexican food, you know. So, like, it's a very unique place in that sense that we really just want to be there.
Yeah.
And to highlight that this is, I think, really the most authentic business incubator space in Rochester. When we talk about, like, tech incubators everywhere, we talk about all these other incubators. I'm like, no, these are minority-owned businesses actually doing something. You know, these are Mexican, Colombian, Venezuelan, Ecuadorian restaurants, like individuals who are currently worried about their own status in this country, and yet they are creating a business.
Yeah, I do want to get into that. That's very serious. But just speaking about the business portion of the talk is you're at International Plaza now. This is your gig now. When you walk in on day one, what are like one or two things you saw that you said, wow, what a wonderful foundation. I'm not going to touch that. But then also, what are one or two things you looked at and said, hey, this is where I'm going to sink my teeth in. I think I can improve upon this.
Oh, great question. I think for me, it was outreach that needed to be improved. I felt like we kept it to our community. And that was one big push. It was like, I had to, you know, I reached out to, you know, Rochester Rotary. I reached out to TGW. I annoyed Visit Rochester to get us more coverage. And, you know, to me, it was like, we need to spread this message that we're doing something so 100% unique in the city of Rochester. And that was something that I know that needed to be fixed. And that's something that we need to really work on, because we were great internally. We were great keeping it with, you know, the city of Rochester was doing their press, keeping it with the public market outreach. But we needed to spread it, like, and expand that. Okay. And I think that was something we had to do. But then I think you asked, what would something,
What were you, I mean, it's probably an obvious answer, but what was something that was so strong that you were just like, man, this is just perfect. I'm not going to.
Yeah. I think really the previous leadership was so perfect. I think Jessica, and Lissandra Maniz, like, both of them had my position before me. Learning from them was just like, cool. I had to kind of go, okay, I'm not going to step on your feet. I'm not going to rewrite the book of what you've done. I want you guys here. You have already created really strong events that you've done, like, when you were in my position, but also you still want to be in charge of. So I want those events. Like, Dominican Day is a great example. Jessica had the job, was the first person to have my position at the Plaza. She had it for a year, but then she moved over into marketing and development for Abero. When she had that position, she created Dominican Day. Developed the committee, and this year we had the largest numbers we've ever had for Dominican Day. I think we still don't know the exact number, but it was somewhere over 3,400-500 people.
Amazing.
Yeah. Holy, which is cow. Massive.
That's huge.
And we still had room in the Plaza.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, it was insane to think that, like, it was actually not too crowded. It was just crazy to think, but, like, so that gave in just what she did alone with her committee was amazing. And then Lissandra, who is just so in tune with the Latino community in Rochester, like, she just knows where to do, like, what, how to get some stuff done. Like, she was helping me with community connections that I didn't know I needed. So I think that stuff I didn't want to change.
Cool.
I didn't want to change what they were doing and what Augustine was doing with the vendors.
So, to the vendors real quick, can you describe who are the vendors? I mean, maybe you can list them all, but if you can't, give me as many as you can. Where are they coming from? You mentioned incubator before. I didn't realize, is it all startups?
Yeah, they're all startups.
I did not realize that it was exclusively startups.
Yeah, they're all.
How do you define startup? Less than X amount of years, X amount of revenue? Like, how?
Yeah, I would say these are first time, almost all of them are first time business owners, and all of them are creating something that is, you know, they are literally creating the American dream.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we are people, many of these are people who've only been in the United States, some of them for not even 5 years, less than 5 years. Okay. Some of them came during the pandemic, some came after. So these are people, individuals who are like, I want to start a business. I want to start something, you know, celebrating my food, my culture, and my identity. And I want to do that. So they went through our business programs, through the business center.
What does the program look like? I'm a young Latino guy. I want to start my business. I don't know how to start a business. Get me in your basic.
Oh, that's
program.
A great Augustine question. I'm gonna, Augustine, don't kill me. I don't want to butcher it.
That's okay.
Augustine kind of looks at it through the sense of, you need to build these relationships first, you know, figure out your taxes, figure out your issues, figure out what you can do and what your product is that is unique, you know, and really hustle to create something that's unique. We know some of these businesses may not last, but also a lot of them have lasted. Munchies, empanadas that you see at the Palm Park, that's something that started at the Plaza early on. Yeah, you know, so we've had vendors that have stayed 2 or 3 years at the Plaza that just left because they just wanted to retire. You know, like, we had Flan Rico, which was amazing. She made flan, she made bacalito, which is like a fried cod. Like, it's like a pureed cod, but then we fry it.
Oh.
So it's like a fried dough, but made out of cod.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Yeah. You know, my people got the bacalao on,
yeah, it's like
on
bacalao, yeah.
Feast of the Seven Fishes.
Yeah,
I got
it's
kind of
like a bacalao, bacalito.
Yeah,
it's
yeah, bacalao. Little ones.
Yeah, little ones, but they're big. They're like this.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
Can I back you up for a second? You said, what about your product is unique? That is brilliant, because in food, everyone wants to come to the table with, I make the best blank.
Yeah.
And you probably do. but everyone does. Everyone makes the best blank. What is it about it that is truly different? How do you get my attention on it? It's probably the best. I'm sure it's delicious. But you said unique, and that is such a great tip. Think about what differentiates you, because empanada, just because you said it, they make an amazing empanada.
Yeah,
right?
We have four different vendors that make four different empanadas.
And they're all amazing.
They're all different.
So what is it that is different? Right. That is a good business lesson as well.
Yeah. And I think that's very unique. Like so we have Alex Garcia, who's an amazing, you know, just a hustler. I love him. And he has his Dimitera, which is, you know, Mexican and Colombian food. So he makes a unique dish called the Colombian tamale, which is a banana leaf wrapped tamale with everything. I like to call it, he hates it, but I call it the Colombian garbage bag. He's like, no, Jason, it's not the Colombian garbage bag.
Well, you know what? In Rochester.
In Rochester, I'm like,
it's the only place on earth where calling food garbage is a compliment.
Yeah. It yeah. Is. He didn't get that. Yeah. It was like, but then he's like, you've had the garbage plate. He's like, I know, but this is not the garbage plate. Like, but it's kind of, it has rice dough. It has a whole hard boiled egg. It has chicken in it. You know, it's delicious. But he also makes a very unique dish, which, you know, he makes these Colombian empanadas, which are made out of cornmeal. They're gluten-free empanadas. You know, I get the ones with blood sausage because I love blood sausage. I'm weird like that.
Yeah.
You know, and or chorizo in it. Like, so I want something very unique.
That is unique.
Yeah.
That's
then,
what I'm talking
And then
about.
We have a Venezuelan vendor, Roxy, who makes a Venezuelan version of the empanada, which is cornmeal, but bigger. You know, and it has like a chicken salad or a chicken, you know, like a chicken and vegetables like inside of it. And then she makes an arepa, which is like a cornmeal pancake burger.
Oh, my God.
Which is delicious.
Dude.
Delicious. So ground beef or ground chicken. It's just amazing. And I think like we, you know, like there's so much different food that's so unique to each one of these different cultures. And I think I love that. I love that about the plaza, and I love that these vendors are like, hey, just try this. You know, like Alex started making Colombian, he calls them Colombian chicken pies, and it's like an circled empanada, but like with like a chicken, a Colombian cake, he calls it Colombian cake, which is like that. It's like a circled empanada, but like a patty size amount of meat or chicken inside.
Well, dude, you haven't mentioned a Cuban vendor yet. You got
I have tried. There's one. There's one on Lyle. I've asked him, and he likes to point out that he's like, "Oh, North Clinton is rough," and I'm like, "So is Lyle." What are you like, what is the issue? We're working on it. Like, I would like a Cuban vendor, but
can you school a white guy for a second? Cuba. When I hear Cuban, I think Cubano. I think the sandwich.
Yeah, the sandwich.
Is that legit, or is that kind of like, that's what
actually, the Cuban sandwich actually came from Yerbo City, Florida. It was made for Cubans, but it was made for the cigar factory in Yerbo City. So it actually is more American than Cuban.
That's what I thought. It's like chicken parm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So what is real Cuban food then?
I mean, I think Cuban tamales, Cuban desserts, the way we do our coffee, cafecitos, our Cuban coffee, which is really sweet coffee. We put a lot of sugar in it, almost like pureed amount of sugar, so that it becomes like coffee syrup. Okay. We love a good shot of really strong coffee, but with a lot of sugar. Café con leche, which is condensed milk and coffee. So really, that is very unique to Cuba. I think a lot more seafood dishes. But yeah, we love our desserts. That's why most Cubans don't have fake teeth and diabetes. But yeah, the Cuban sandwich is great, but it really, it's hard to kind of differentiate food of the Caribbean because we share so much, you know? So like, you know, like, yes, Cubans do have empanadas, but that's, I actually think more empanadas come from like are surprisingly more Central American, but they've crossed over into Caribbean culture. But I mean, it's just, I think our rice dishes are a little bit different. But it's like, I don't know, it's so hard to, it's like regions in Italy. Like, you want to break down a region in Italy, like breaking down a different version of like the arroz con frijoles in Cuba. Actually, no, we love black beans, like black beans on rice. The Puerto Ricans, you don't get black beans on rice. You don't get black beans on rice in a lot of other places, but Cubans love black beans on rice.
Okay. You know where I visited and ate my way through was, I think it's called Little Havana in Miami.
Yeah.
I wanted to go there so bad. I did, ate my way right through there. Freaking fantastic.
Our desserts are amazing, aren't they? Like, oh, we yeah. love our desserts.
Where is the famous cake? Tres Leches, right?
And yeah.
Where is that from?
Tres Leches, that's Cuban.
That yeah. is Cuban?
Yeah, it's okay. Cuban dessert.
That's good stuff. Yeah. Man. They sell it right in the grocery store in Florida, too.
I know.
Publix, you can get it right.
Yeah, it's that is very, very Cuban. Actually, a lot of Cuban, like, there is a joke amongst Cubans. If, like, you ask my abuela where she learned how to cook, she'll go, in exile. Because we had cooks in Cuba. If you're middle class, everyone had a cook, you know? So for the first generation of people who came, often the dishes were what ended up becoming like the Cuban sandwich or like these traditional Cuban dishes that you see like at Cuban restaurants throughout Florida and throughout New York. But it was not so like recently where you have a lot of people who stayed who've been coming back here and their dishes have been, you know, I discovered like these amazing seafood and rice dishes and seafood stews that I never had until I had a cousin come up in the last 15 years and he started making the dishes. Mm-hmm. And I remember being at Thanksgiving, looking at my mom and my grandmother going like, where has this been our whole lives? Like, you have destroyed us. Because they only learned the dishes that they learned when they came here in exile. And they didn't know that many dishes. And I think that's so unique. When I hear people at the plaza go like, but oh, that's not like this Mexican. That's not like the Mexican I have at Bitter Honey, or this is not like this. And I'm just sitting there going like, yeah, this is as close as you're going to get to real Mexican. This is the closest you're going to get to real Venezuelan and Ecuadorian food. You know, so like that, you shouldn't complain if it's not like the same Puerto Rican dish or the same, you know, right. Cuban dish that you've had here your whole life.
Yeah.
So,
well, let me talk some business with you for a second. So, first of all, I think that's cool as shit, right? The fact that, like, that Mexican that I'm going to get at that International Plaza is the most authentic Mexican I'm going to find.
He's going to be proud. Yeah.
That's going to be the stuff. That's what it's like to eat food in Mexico. But you just mentioned, like, a Bitter Honey or a Salinas, some of the Mexican restaurants in Rochester that you probably would go, like, no, that ain't it. But can I ask you, what advice would you give to the person making the authentic Mexican? Is the business viable without somehow Americanizing it?
That's a great question. I mean, it's hard because I think a lot of it's like how we perceive the culture. Why is it that the higher end restaurants in Rochester allow us to have an authentic Italian or French experience?
But not authentic
Latin experience.
I'll argue you a little bit. I mean, I mentioned chicken parm earlier.
That's true.
Like, it's not really authentic. Yeah. Like, there are a couple authentic.
I am going to be getting sick and tired of like the 80th Brick Iron Pizza place.
Yeah, right. But like, there's only a couple of like really authentic Italian restaurants in Rochester, and I don't think the Italian dishes are necessarily their highest sellers.
No, it's true.
And just to show you a little bit that I'm not just completely talking shit is, so I did live for 1 year in Italy. I was an exchange student, and it was far more Mediterranean than I thought. Coming from America, I thought it was going to be all red sauce, meatballs, pasta, pizza.
Olive oil. I was there for a month. I remember.
Olive oil. Vegetables, way more seafood.
Seafood is so good.
But very like, just very Mediterranean. Like the type of pasta dishes I might get at Aladdin's on Monroe Avenue were closer to the pasta dishes I would get in Italy. Just oil-based with eggplant and zucchini and just all the vegetables, right? And olives everywhere, always olives.
Oh, yeah.
So I would argue a little bit that when I do go, like, well, listen, I'm a red sauce joint guy. I love me some spaghetti and meatballs, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But
same, I'm Italian, American. Like,
but Mama G's, red sauce. Like your top most authentic are probably like Mama G's, maybe Lucano, maybe Fiamma Centro.
Fiamma Centro is very good.
Very good.
Very
but
good.
He has, in some ways, Americanized that thing a bit.
It is a hard thing. I think it's an assimilation thing. I see that, and it's like, but where is the line?
Yeah.
You know, like it's, I remember talking to Zach, who's the owner of Bitter Honey, like one of the guys. And I remember sitting there and he told me like, yeah, we were really striving for early on to make more authentic dishes. And then like, what happened? He's like, I just had a lot of people start complaining. We want spicy. We want this. And I'm like, but Mexican food is not that spicy, or, you know, or like I've gone to Cuban restaurants in New York City and they have a hot sauce rack and you're like, this is sacrilege. Like, you go to Florida, you're not going to see hot sauce on a Cuban dish. You're going to probably see a lot more salt and sugar.
Yeah.
But, like, you're not going to have hot sauce.
Let me just relate it to something here, actually. So this is a sauce plant. We make salsa.
You make really great salsa.
We make some really good ones, I think. Thank you very much.
I love your stuff.
But we make some salsas here. And we make plenty of salsas that are diced tomato, pepper, garlic, onion, bell pepper, jalapeno is always going to be cilantro. But then we have this one brand we make called Walito. And I hope she wouldn't mind me saying that we make it because sometimes there's NDAs in place, but I think she's going to be proud. This woman is from Mexico. She lives about 3 hours away. I think she's in the Albany area. She drives here every time to make it with us because it has to be right. And it is way different than any of the other salsas we make. And it's because it's real. It's authentic.
Yeah.
But it's just blends of pureed peppers and tomatoes. And, you know, like, not jalapeno.
I think we forget that it's something that, like, we don't realize we're pressuring the culture to change when we're forcing it to change. And I think what ends up happening is I've seen this happen. It's not just like a white or it's just an American thing. You know, it doesn't define by race. It really is this idea that, like, oh, we like it food this way. Can you keep making it this way? Mm. And we don't want you to change it. So you have to assimilate your culture to fit where our norms are.
So we're killing culture by doing that.
Sometimes, I sometimes think, like, I'm sick and tired. Yeah. Like, I think, like, there is an obsession in America on hot sauce.
Yeah,
you know,
is,
like,
no
and
doubt.
It's just like, I mean, one of the best. I mean, I do love watching my show Hot Ones, but I'm not gonna go out and eat that hot sauce. And 90% of the most hottest hot sauce are made in America.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But they all have Latin names.
That crowd,
you know, which is like really annoying to be like, los vamos, los caliente, and it's like, where is Maine? Knoxville, Tennessee.
Anyway, yeah. I can't. I got to remember decipher between what I know and what I'm not supposed to publicly know. But anyway, yes, you're right.
Mm-hmm. And you're just sitting there going like that. That is that is cultural appropriation sometimes not always at its best. I'm not saying it's at worst because I don't want to trash it, but it's not at its best. And I think it's just unaware. They're just like, maybe we should just keep it authentic. Maybe we should try to keep it authentic and just, you know, the more that they experience it, the more they're going to like it.
Yes,
you know, like, and
give in too easily. This customer always right thing in America is not the way other countries do things. In Italy,
they would kick you out of the restaurant.
Yes,
if you complained about the food.
If they serve seafood at this restaurant and you go in there asking for meat, they're going to say this is not the meat restaurant. But in America, a seafood restaurant's going to have a chicken dish because they've just learned the customer's always right.
Or then that person's going to get sued.
Yeah, but you're so right about, like, we have assimilated to the point of, just God. And so back to Giuseppe, the guy that runs Fiamma Centro. I interviewed him years ago, and I asked him about this exact thing, about how, like, in Italy, you wouldn't ask for a modification. Maybe in Rome, where the tourists are, but in a small town, like, you wouldn't ask for a modification on something. And he explained it to me that way. He said, you come to the restaurant because the restaurant does those things. And it is not my job to adhere to you. It is your job to go to the restaurant that has the thing you want. So if you come to my restaurant asking me to change my ways, that's on you, not on me. But in America, the restaurants have said, well, that's on us. We'll change our ways.
Yeah.
We'll do whatever to get your money. We'll do anything we need to do. It is a pain in the ass. I do kind of hate it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's hard because it affects the cultural, like, even us, like, I've witnessed our own vendors struggle with that. You know, I've seen the one we're talking about, Alex, who's makes amazing food, but predominantly Puerto Ricans, they've gone there and be like, hey, this previous container had bacalitos. You make bacalitos, and the Mexican menu and Colombian menu are right by their head. You know, and it could be white, it could be black, it could be Puerto Rican. They can all say, well, I want you to make an empanada. I don't like this Mexican. And then I'm just going to go to the Puerto Rican vendor, you know, Johnny, who makes amazing empanadas, amazing rellenas de papas and acapullos. But I kind of go sit there and go, like, so you're also like our own culture,
yeah,
can be at fault. And it, sure. It's the same with Italian American food. Like
I've done
we said there is Italian food, and then when you're in Rochester, there is Italian American. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I'm like, I've given my mom real Italian food, and she'll sit there and go like, yeah, but I still want to go to, you know, like Papa John's. I still want to go to Red Fidelis.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah. You're cute, mom, but she's like, I can't get my chicken French anywhere.
But I'm guilty. I'm right there with it. Like I was at New York Kitchen for 10 years as an instructor, and for a few years, the class was called Where's the Parm? And it was how to make chicken parm and eggplant parm and all that. And that's not Italian.
Nope.
Welcome to the world of Punches and Popcorn, where we dive into the bone-breaking and kung-fu-kicking world of martial arts cinema. Join us on the path as we explore a new movie every episode, discussing the history, fighting styles, science, and more from a broad range of fight films. Everything from Bruce Lee to Jean-Claude Van Damme to John Wick. There's plenty of room in our temple of couch potato style. So listen in and subscribe to Punches and Popcorn on your favorite podcast app.
The Level Up Coffee podcast is now dialed in.
We love coffee and stay connected to every development in the industry, both here in Rochester and worldwide, to bring you our unique perspective on the ever-changing world of coffee.
We're doing regular tastings, reporting on our travels, and trying to hold back tirades about the forces that make the coffee supply chain a neo-colonial mess. Join us on the Lunchador Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts, and stay
dialed in.
Chicken French is not French.
yeah. The other thing that I noticed about Italian food in Italy versus, and I know this is supposed to be about Latino food, I'm sorry, but is that it's much, much heavier here. Like,
yeah.
And what's interesting is that for years and years, I've been telling people like the food, the portions were lighter, the food was lighter, everything was lighter in Italy. Here, Italian food is like weigh you down for the whole day. I need to take a nap, right? And finally, just last week on this podcast, Dr. Carota, Joelle, explained why. She said that because Americans work longer days, that when the immigrants first came over, they were used to working a few hours, having a siesta, and then working a few hours. So they needed more substantial lunches. So they started adding meats and things that they wouldn't have previously added to lunch in Italy back home. Here it was like, well, here you need to get through 8 hours, so here's just a ton of food, we'll just mix everything in there. I had never heard that before.
I had never heard that either. That's, and I thought, so that was
cool.
And I think that happens everywhere. I think like you can go to a Mexican, or you can go to a Cuban, a Puerto Rican joint, and that ends up happening. It's interesting, like if you go to a Puerto Rican or Dominican place here, it's all buffet style. You know, everybody has to get like, and it's either small, medium, or large, you know, containers, and you get loaded up with whatever you want. Yeah. There's the meat, there's the juca, there's the pinin, there's the chicken, you know, like there's the rice, and you get this loaded dish. But yeah, I would imagine if I went to Cuba, it wouldn't be 10 times smaller because it's a, you know, like, but like, you know, even in Puerto Rico, it'll probably be a lot smaller, and you're not going to have the buffet style.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, again, it's like, this is what happens, you know, like,
totally.
It's a sense of like, yeah, well, you got to do this to survive. You have to do that to survive. If you make it super authentic, you're not going to survive.
So let's get serious for a second. You mentioned it earlier. I was planning on getting to it, but let's talk about it now. And by the way, I'm a liberal, so I'm a friend, right? but I'm also a white guy born and raised in America. So this whole ICE thing, this hasn't even gotten into my bubble. You know,
yeah.
I've been insulated from this. You've seen it. You were talking before about that. You've seen can you take me into that world and let me know what is the climate like?
I can't always speak of everything because we do protect people.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, but
whatever you can.
Well, it's a fear, you know, and a lot of our vendors, clientele have. They're not coming to the plaza because they're afraid. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to be out and open. They may order the food and drive it back home. You know, they'll call the vendor or Grubhub the vendor, and you know, but they're afraid to come out. And that's a reality that our vendors have told us. Yeah. Our vendors are all on different spectrums of the assimilation, like on either or their TPS, which is temporary protection services, or they're one that has a visa, one, like, you know, actually two have visas, and one of them are working through their process, you know, and two are working through the process, and one's Puerto Rican, so one's a U.S. citizen. So like, it's a complicated narrative of, and there's a fear when we open the plaza. Yeah, we were worried. Thank God, knock on wood, that, you know, hopefully nobody, you know, like it is, yeah. It's something that we worry about, but we're also strengthened that we are joyfully, as I like to say, resisting the kind of cultural norms by our embracing and just sharing our culture, sharing the joy of our food, our language, and our music is important.
Well, and just, go ahead.
Sorry. No.
I was just going to say, just so you know, from somebody who, as I said, privilege, call it whatever you want to, I've been insulated in my bubble of, I haven't had to personally worry about that. I'm aware of it. I am so incredibly sorry that it is happening. It is insane to me to think that there could be a group of people experiencing and spreading joy who have to actually be in fear that a gang is going to freaking roll up and start saying, show me some ID.
Yeah.
That is fucking insane that we live in that world. And I try not to get too political on this podcast because I, unfortunately, I've got too much going on in the world now that I got to try and hide it. But sometimes the liberal still comes out.
That's the thing we need to embrace. And I've told this to, you know, protest organizations. I've said, if you really want to fight ICE, if you want to fight this system, go support those businesses. Go to the businesses you know are immigrant run. Okay. And I'm not just talking Latin businesses, Somalian, Nepalese, Ethiopian, Yemenis, you know, Asian. ICE went to the Asian market. You know, like, you have to think that they're not just going after one population. Yes, they are going specifically after, like, there is a strong focus on the Hispanic community, but there's also, you need to be there. You don't need to be in Martin Luther King Park. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be mean, but you don't really need to be at Brighton Four Corners with signs saying no kings. You need to be there at that restaurant. You need to be at the plaza every Sunday. You need to be calling them saying, hey, I want to buy food. I want to get this for you. Because that fights it. That helps the businesses. You are becoming, I don't want to say the word savior. You're not becoming that. You're becoming our buffers. You know, the black and white community have a benefit in this day and age to use that protection. They are the protection. You know, they are, and they need to be that more in this day and age. And I think they forget that. They forget, hey, it's easier to organize a protest. No, it's easier. It'd actually be easier if you ordered some food from us.
That is so insightful and full of wisdom, and I feel schooled. I hope people listening to this feel schooled because you are so right. You're so right. And I have to do a better job.
We talked about that during Black Lives Matter, but like the reality of what makes protest movements stronger is when there's a financial stake. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they see that money go into the right places, they're going to get afraid. You know, the places that really make the change. To the individuals and help to make the change, you know, like that changes it.
Okay, so let's change behavior right now. Tell me, International Plaza, give me the plug, you know, that we're open on these days.
Well,
these
we are times. We are closing for the season soon, but we will still be open throughout the fall. But we are open Wednesday through Sunday on noon to 5. All of our vendors are on our Facebook page. You go to International Plaza, or you can go to the International Plaza website, which is actually part of the City of Rochester Public Market. We have vendor applications. We have site rental applications. If your business wants to do a site event, you know, if it's under 200, it's a pretty cheap event. We can, you know, for less than 100 people, it's like $300. Yeah, and less than like 200, it's like 300. You know, so it's pretty cheap. And if you want to be a vendor, if you want to be a food vendor, and you can, even if you want to have a tent food vendor, it's $40 for any of our events. And we have events going all the way up until October 13th. So I know it's coming close and we're having, you know, but if you go to our website, you fill out the application, you drop off that application at the public market, the brick building in the middle of the public market, and you drop $20 off, you're already going to have a table, you know, and it's pretty easy.
You mentioned being an incubator too. You're helping businesses get started. Yeah. Do you help them understand health permits and things you guys
hold a hand? We walk through that. Yeah. Erica Perez, who is over at the public market, she will guide through all the permits. Hey, you just need this. If you are a food vendor, yeah, we need your safe serve and your health insurance and, you know, like see that you've actually gone through the health department, mm-hmm. you know, and you have like a proper kitchen to serve food. But, you know, if you are, like, for example, your stuff, you don't need that because you already have everything canned and, you know.
Well,
like,
we're yeah. under plenty of regulation. Yeah. It's not health department.
But it's not health yeah. department. You yeah, don't yeah. have to do that because yeah. you're, you know, you're.
Eggs
but if
market.
You're selling stuff, yeah, you're just like the public market. You just sell. Mm-hmm. So that's easy, you know, like you. But like if you're a product, if you have like a product, if you have a nonprofit, you know, your business, you can sponsor. It's we're a very affordable rate for sponsoring. Sponsoring our events throughout the season, especially our 2026 season, that would be very helpful. Like, you know, like to highlight your business. We will be showcasing your business every single day on our flyers, our website, our, you know, and our vendors would be happy because what you end up doing is helping strengthen like that community and that outreach. We've had really great help this year from ESL, Rochester Prep, Molina Health. But it helps to really do outreach. You know, we have so many food and restaurant vendors help with Dominican Day and Rock Con Poder. Almost every single Latin restaurant in Rochester has in some way helped sponsor the plaza. They've either been there or they've even financially sponsored us from the $100,000 to $5,000, $10,000 level. So, you know, it's amazing to see, you know, Casa Campo sponsor our Domino's and sponsor many of our events, you know, so, or, you know, like Cordaro or Tequila, Tacos and Tequila, you know, like seeing those people like wanting to step in and say, we're just helping our community. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So there's so many different avenues.
You got a lot of good sauces down there too.
Yeah.
If you want to, now, you know, it's the end of the season now, but if you want to next year, we could do a sauce off or something.
Oh my gosh.
And
yeah.
I will offer a free run. You know, we'll commercialize a product.
Oh my God. That would be amazing.
We'll make it not cost them a penny. Whoever wins the sauce competition, whatever yeah. we come up with, and we'll commercialize their sauce for them, and we'll give them their first, you know, 30 cases free, or like first batch completely free.
Oh my God, that's amazing. That's so cool. No,
yeah. Keep in the back of your head for next year.
I will. And you know, if you guys can always reach out to me, you know, like,
go ahead, give your info.
Yeah, Jason Barber, jason.barber@abarodevelopment.org, or jasonbarber82@gmail. Just reach out to me and I will, you know, guide you to the right resources. We really just want to create a safe space and a beautiful space and an oasis for our city. And I think what's so unique is some of the stuff that for years we talked about with Parcel 5, we've been doing in, you know, like we're doing the commissary, but we're doing it at the most grassroots level.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. The commissary's killing it as well. And I've talked to the person who runs the commissary, you know, but like both of us are in the same boat. We're trying from the grassroots to give people, especially people who are just coming to this country, the reality of the American dream and give you a unique international cuisine in your city. You know, like I always like to say, if you want the world to try the food of the world, you just need to go down south of North Clinton. You know, like it's from Asia down to Latin America to all the way even to Europe and Irondequoit.
Yeah.
It's all on North and South Clinton.
Didn't you say earlier, and I know you want people to come in person, but this is better than nothing. Didn't you mention Grubhub earlier? Are some of them on Grubhub?
Yeah, Dimitera's on Grubhub. I believe Roxy's Arepas, Venezuelan, she's on Grubhub. But yeah, two of our vendors I know are currently on Grubhub.
Cool.
And Dimitera, the Mexican vendor I was talking about, if you go to Dimitera or just type up Colombian food on Grubhub, he's like number one on Colombian food.
And I just want to make sure I get there before the season ends. You said the season ends soon, but you didn't say the date. What's the last open day?
So the last official Sunday event will be March 12th or 13th, I believe.
March
12th. Yeah, October. Sorry.
October.
October 12th.
Okay.
We will be having a Christmas event around December 7th, but our vendors will be open. You can reach out to our vendors anytime. And most of our vendors, our two front vendors, Dimitera and New Generation Eats, will be open throughout the season. They usually don't close because they have heated containers.
Oh, good. Okay.
But our other vendors, La Salinas de Padillas, which is a Puerto Rican vendor, she'll most likely be open up until December, and so will weather permitting. The other three vendors will be open until December.
This comes out September 28th, so 2 weeks from today, the day this comes out, is when everything. So you still have 2 full weeks of it being open Wednesday through Sunday
for events,
for
events and music. But Wednesday through Sunday, our vendors will still be there.
Got it.
But many of our vendors will still be there. Right. And if you just go to our plaza, you'll see our vendors linked websites, or like you'll see them, like their accounts, say, okay, I'll look up this, boom, you'll find it.
Perfect. Dude, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for inviting me, man. I feel
secretly you're gonna like stop at Ralph and Rosie's on your way home, or like
what's if I have time. What time is it? Maybe.
You know, we start bottling their sweet pizza sauce.
Oh, let's see if maybe I can. It's so good.
I might be able to snatch one.
I may snatch one before I leave. I gotta snatch one.
Yeah.
Because I love that stuff.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for inviting me.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.